yellow packet. I'll bet you can't finish the yellow packet before I finish the purple packet, I said. Ernie's eyes narrowed. That's not fair. You're a better reader than me. So? You're better than me at kickball and basketball, and I still play. That's different, he said. How? It just is. I shrugged and returned to my seat. Ernie followed me. You're already almost finished with purple, and I'm just starting yellow. Sister Joan looked up from her desk. Ernie, are we having trouble finding our seat? No, sister. Then I suggest you find it and read in silence. Ernie took his seat in the row next to me. I opened my book and acted like I was reading quickly, turning the pages.
It's dumb, he whispered.
I turned the pages faster. Sister Joan walked out to the quad. She kept the door open when the weather was nice. A draft rattled the window blinds, making a noise like baseball cards in the spokes of a bike wheel. I turned to Ernie.
It's not dumb when it's kickball or three flies up, when you know you're going to win.
I checked the door out of the corner of my eye but saw no sign of Sister Joan.
But when I'm good at something, you're chicken.
Several people in the class heard this challenge and uttered, ooh.
Fine, Ernie said. But you have to finish purple and olive blue.
I'll be done by Friday, I said. Ernie finished the yellow packet Thursday. One afternoon later that year, Mrs. Cantwell stopped by to pick up Ernie on her way home from work and delivered a chocolate cake she'd baked. I heard her talking to my mother about Ernie's dramatic improvement in his reading. After Mrs. Cantwell and Ernie had left for home, my mother called me down to the kitchen. Though it was nearing dinner, she cut me an enormous slice of cake and poured a tall glass of milk. I thought it was a test of some kind, but my mother handed me a fork and brushed her hand through my hair. I'd say Ernie is lucky to have a friend like you. 8. I would remember middle school for the arrival of a new student at OLM who would have a profound impact on my life. Michaela Kennedy started school shortly after the Christmas holidays, when we returned to start the second semester of the sixth grade. I overheard a couple of girls talking about Michaela, who went by Mickey. Rumor had it, Mickey got in some type of trouble at the public school, and her parents enrolled her at OLM, hoping the nuns could straighten her out. I sensed Mickey was different from other girls the very first day. She did not wear her hair long or pulled back in a ponytail, or twisted in braids with bows and ribbons. She cut it so short it barely touched her ears, which were not pierced. The school required that skirts extend to 1 inch above the knee, but to me it seemed Mickey's skirt inched higher each day. I heard one of the lunch ladies admonish Mickey for showing too much leg. Mickey retorted, I wouldn't be showing any leg if they'd let us wear pants like the boys. That comment got her a detention, picking up trash for the remainder of the lunch period. Mickey gravitated to the boys and forsook the girls entirely, not interested in practicing cheers or jumping rope. Mickey played kickball and basketball, though it didn't start out that way. Boys in the class denied her admittance into our exclusive domain, but we learned quickly that Mickey was not to be denied. What, are you afraid a girl might beat you? She'd say, dropping the challenge that no self-respecting boy could walk away from. Then, she would proceed to not just beat them, but humiliate them. Only Ernie was willing to readily accept Mickey, and his doing so had nothing to do with any understanding of discrimination. Ernie liked to win, and he quickly recognized Mickey's proficiency at sports. This resulted in my being demoted from Ernie's partner, and I resented Mickey for it. For a month, I silently seethed as I watched her and Ernie beat the stuffing out of all challengers in foursquare and wall ball, ignoring their accomplishments as if I couldn't have cared less. But I would soon learn Mickey was also not a person one could easily ignore. 9. The end of January marked another all-school mass, and our class was responsible for the presentation. This was not an insignificant affair. Not just the entire school attended the mass,
but parents and members of the general congregation as well. My mother never missed one. As a responsible grade, we were to choose and present the readings, prayers of the faithful, serve as the altar boys, sing in the choir, and bring up the gifts. To be chosen as the lector, however, was universally considered the highest honor. The position offered the greatest exposure, and therefore the greatest risk. This wasn't to discount the off chance an altar boy could catch his robe on fire on a candle, or that a student carrying the gifts up the aisle might stumble and toss the wafers into the crowd, but I'd never seen that happen. I had seen a lector screw up a reading at an all-school mass. We all had. The prior year, Anna Louise Gretzky had walked up the steps to the lectern, looked out over the crowd, and failed to utter a single word. We all thought Gretzky was employing a dramatic pause until Father Killian, our new pastor, looked up from his throne, anxious to get going. We quickly realized that Anna Louise Gretzky had frozen as solid as a block of ice. After another tense minute, one of the nuns climbed the steps and escorted a dazed and still silent Gretzky back to her seat. That had not been the end of her humiliation, however. She endured taunts and jibes for the better part of the remainder of the year. Monday, as our class began the task of dividing up the assignments, the frozen image of Anna Louise Gretzky remained a vivid reminder that being lector was not for the faint of heart. Students could volunteer for any position, but you had to be nominated to be lector. Since the vote was by a show of hands, the winner was usually the most popular student in the class, like Ernie, or maybe Valerie Johnson, the head cheerleader. "Let's start with the gift bearers," Sister Mary Williams said. The students had nicknamed the elderly nun Sister Muffin because her face looked squished and wrinkled beneath her coif. She also wore Coke bottle thick, black-framed glasses that magnified her eyes to look like two blue marbles underwater. Sister Mary Williams wrote the names of the first four volunteers on the chalkboard in her flowing, cursive style. The slots for the ushers and greeters also quickly filled. "Who would like to be an altar boy?" Sister asked. I was about to raise my hand when Ernie said, "I'll do it," taking himself out of contention for lector. I knew Ernie's decision had to do with his uneasiness about reading in public, and as I sat contemplating his decisions, two of my other classmates quickly raised their hands to join him. I had been shut out. The only thing left for those of us not chosen for any other tasks was the choir, which was like being a stagehand at a play, all the work without any of the glory. Sister Mary Williams moved to the final position on the board and without fanfare said, "All right, I'll take nominations for lector." The clock above the cloakroom buzzed as the big hand struck 10. With Ernie out of the running, Valerie Johnson, the girl who'd given me an envelope with a dead fly in it on Valentine's Day in the first grade, was a shoo-in. Taking nominations was a waste of time. "I nominate Sam Hill." I think every head in the class turned as if they'd heard a foreign language being spoken. The nomination had come from Mary Beth Potts, a cheerleader and Valerie Johnson's best friend. Potts had never said more than a few sentences to me. I had no idea why she nominated me. Even Sister Mary Williams hesitated before turning to scrawl my name on the blackboard. A loud murmur ensued, along with a lot of whispers and giggles. I heard Ernie urgently whispering my name, "Sam! Sam!" Ernie sat in the row to my right and two seats behind me. When I turned, his face was grave, and he was shaking his head. "Say no," he said. "No." No? Was he crazy? Nothing short of my announcing that I intended to become a Catholic priest would make my mother prouder than to see me standing at the lectern in front of the entire school. As for me, this was my chance to show not only my classmates, but all their parents that I was just a normal kid. As I contemplated this, with Ernie continuing to try to get my attention, I saw another hand go up. Mickey Kennedy. My anger swelled. It would be just like this newcomer to tank my candidacy. She'd stolen Ernie, Now she intended to steal my chance at glory. But to my surprise, Mickey said, "I second the nomination." This was a clear breach of the election protocol, there being no need to second the nomination. Then Mickey blurted out even louder, "And I say we vote." Valerie Johnson quickly raised her hand, and the hands of the others in her entourage followed. The boys also raised their hands, Ernie being the last to do so and looking reluctant.
"Congratulations, Sam," Sister Mary Williams said.
It might have been the happiest moment of my short life, next to the day my father drove up the driveway with the red Schwinn bicycle. I only hoped for a better ending.
10.
At recess, Ernie quickly chased me down.
"Sam! Sam!"
"What's wrong?" I said. "Why didn't you want to vote for me?" Ernie hesitated.
"They want you to fail, Sam. I saw Valerie Johnson whispering to Mary Beth to nominate you. I think they want you to freeze like Anna Louise Gretzky so they can make fun of you."
"What? How do you know that? Did you hear her?" Ernie shook his head.
"But it's Valerie Johnson," he said. "Why would she nominate you?"
"She didn't. It was Mary Beth."
"Valerie told her to nominate you, Sam."
I ignored this well-reasoned rationale because I wanted the position. "So why shouldn't I be lector? I'm the best student in the class."
"You should turn it down, Sam. Just tell Sister you can't do it."
"No," I said emphatically.
"What if something happens?"
"Like what?"
"I don't know. They do something to embarrass you, and you screw up."
"I'm not going to screw up," I said. As recess was coming to an end, I found myself walking back to class beside Mickey. With Ernie's admonition fresh in my mind, I asked her, "Why'd you nominate me?"
"Don't get a swollen head, Hill," she said. "You're a brain. You should be the lector. Better you than that airhead Valerie Johnson or one of her stupid friends."
Then Mickey punched me on the arm and ran off to the classroom at the sound of the bell. 11. After school, I raced home, dropped my bike on the lawn, and rushed through the front door.
"Mom! Mom!
Samuel Hill!" My mother emerged from the kitchen, wiping her hands on a dish towel.
"What have I told you about bellowing my name like a banshee?"
"I got it," I said. "A girl in my class nominated me, and Mickey seconded it, and the vote was unanimous. Every kid."
"Slow down," my mother said.
"Start over. You got what?"
"Lector! At the all-school mass on Friday. I got it."
My mother did not, however, whoop for joy or immediately embrace me as I had expected.
"They elected you?"
"Yeah, it was unanimous."
"Samuel," my mother said, still somewhat solemn.
"What's the matter?" I said. "I thought you'd be happy."
"I am," my mother said, forcing a smile.
Then she hugged me.
"Oh, Samuel, I am happy, and I'm proud of you. That is a great honor. Won't your father be proud?"
"I have two readings and the responsorial psalm," I said, pulling back from her.
"That's when you raise your hand, like this."
I raised my hand.
"Then everyone knows it's their turn. I have to get started right away."
"Well, I can certainly help," my mother said. "You know, I did theater in college."
"Really?"
The thought of my mother doing anything except being a mother seemed highly unlikely, but theater came as a real surprise. I would have thought she'd consider acting a display of vanity.
"I'll have you know I played Elizabeth in Pride and Prejudice."
I had no idea if that was a big deal, but from the grin on my mother's face, I could tell it meant something to her.
"That's great, Mom. Can you help me?"
12. We studied and worked on the readings each day after school, my mother helping me with the pronunciations of the difficult words and then with my posture and presentation.
"Hold your head high," she said. "Make eye contact with the audience before you speak. Slow down. You're rushing."
After posture and presentation, she moved to voice inflection, which words to emphasize. This resulted in a few disagreements between my parents.
"No, no. Emphasize not. Don't emphasize road," my father would say.
"Emphasize road," my mother would correct.
My mother made a makeshift lectern by having me stand on several volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica, and I would perform the readings after dinner. My parents surely must have tired of these performances, but if they did, they never complained.
"We have a regular showman,"
my father said one evening as we sat down for meatloaf and mashed potatoes with gravy. "He gets it from me," my mother said. "You know, I played Elizabeth in Pride and Prejudice in college."
"How could I forget?" my father said, taking a piece of meatloaf and holding the plate for me. "You kissed Bill Mahler right there on stage before God and man."
I nearly dropped the meatloaf on the floor.
"You kissed another man?" I asked.
"I hope you socked him one, Dad."
"I did not kiss anyone," my mother said. "I was in character. That was Elizabeth." My father rolled his eyes.
"Well, Bill Mahler found it convincing. He asked you out for 2 years after that one kiss, and I would have socked him, Sam. But he was also the captain of the basketball team."
My mother smiled. "I will have you know, Samuel Hill, that I have always only had eyes for one man, and he's sitting right here at this table." I grinned and wedged a green bean between my tongue and the roof of my mouth.
"I wish I could be there in person to hear you, but I'll be there in spirit," my father said.
My father continued to work 6 days a week, leaving the house early and working so late, sometimes that he'd even miss dinner. The table felt empty without him. "We have to tighten our belts," my mother said during one of our meals without him. "A chain pharmacy just opened on Burlingame Avenue, and your father's prescription count has dropped." I was disappointed my father would miss my performance, but I understood how hard he was working. 13. Friday morning, I was nervous, mainly because throughout the week, Ernie had continued to stew over all the things that could go wrong and suggested that I feign an illness or laryngitis. I continued to focus on just one thought. I knew my classmates and their parents still considered me the devil boy. This was surely God's way for me to prove I was a normal kid, maybe even extraordinary, as my mother frequently professed. Who was I to argue with a woman who'd had the lead in Pride and Prejudice? Arriving at school, I slid the front wheel of my bike into the bike stand and snapped the lock through the tire. Ernie skidded to a stop beside me.
"Are you ready?"
"I guess so," I said. We walked up the covered breezeway together, and I was certain the eyes of the entire student body were watching me, and that this would be the best day of my life. Then I opened the door to our classroom and froze. The face that wheeled to greet us had not the soft and comforting features of Sister Mary Williams, but the laser-precise glare of Sister Beatrice. 14. Ernie stumbled into me, not seeing Sister Beatrice.
"What the hell, Sam?"
Our principal's eyes threw daggers at Ernie.
"Detention, Mr. Cantwell. I will not tolerate profanity."
Ernie's shoulders sagged, and he stepped past me and found his seat.
"Do you not know where your seat is, Mr. Hill?"
"Yes, sister. I mean, no, sister."
"Then I suggest you find it."
I took my seat along with my equally depressed classmates.
"Sister Mary Williams is under the weather. I will serve as your substitute. When the bell rings, you will assemble in an orderly fashion and proceed to the church."
Ernie raised his hand.
"Sister, the altar boys need to be at the church early to get set up."
"Does Sister Mary Williams allow you to speak without permission, Mr. Cantwell?"
"No, sister."
"Then I suggest you wait until called upon."
Ernie sat back.
"Was there something you wanted to ask, Mr. Cantwell?"
"No, sister."
"Something about the altar boys having to leave early for church?"
Ernie still did not answer.
"Well, Mr. Cantwell?"
"Whatever." If the room had not already been deathly silent, this would have been one of those moments when you truly could have heard a pin drop.
"You just earned a second detention, Mr. Cantwell, and I shall be sending a note home to your mother to discuss your insolence."
"You're diabetic?"
Peter Hammonds asked. It was an innocent question, I'm sure. Hammonds wasn't the sharpest tool in the shed, and his vocabulary skills were less than stellar. But Sister Beatrice saw it as a further attack on her authority.
And you will be serving detention with Mr. Cantwell, Mr. Hammonds. Anyone else wish to test my patience?
No one did.
Now, who are the altar boys?
Ernie, Maddie Montoya, and Billy Feely raised their hands. Their arms looked like limp noodles.
The altar boys are excused.
Valerie Johnson then raised her hand and, when called upon, said,
Sister, the altar preparers also need to leave early to set up the church.
Sister Beatrice dismissed them. As they departed, Sister Beatrice turned her attention to me.
I suppose you believe you should be allowed to leave ahead of your classmates as well, Mr. Hill.
No, sister, just the altar boys and the altar preparers.
Vanity is a thin, she said,
but it sounded like thin.
Can anyone in the class tell me what vanity is?
This time not even Peter Hammonds would venture a guess.
No one?
Vanity is the excessive belief in one's own abilities or attractiveness.
Do you believe you are better than your classmates, Mr. Hill?
Her words hissed at me like a rattler disturbed from sleep. I noticed her eyes were glassy. I shook my head. No, sister.
Smarter? More important?
No, sister.
Good. Then you shall demonstrate your humility by being last in line entering the church.
When the bell mercifully rang, my classmates and I solemnly lined up against the wall. Sister Beatrice didn't have to worry about us talking. We marched down the playground to the church like prisoners on a forced death march. Not even the crisp winter air could raise our spirits. Outside the grand cathedral doors, we waited for the younger grades to parade down the aisle and take their seats. When our line moved forward, Sister Beatrice reached out and put an arm across my path, the way my mother did when she had to stop the car suddenly. Her eyes bored into mine, and I could smell the alcohol on her breath.
Your classmates chose you because they want to see you fail, she said.
15. As we marched into the church, I became keenly aware of the parents and the rest of the congregation assembled in the pews behind the students in their school uniforms. Valerie Johnson and her cohorts had hung white, reserved signs on the pews for the students. As we waited for the nuns to ensure the usual boy-girl, boy-girl seating, I saw my mother standing beside Mrs. Cantwell. They smiled at me, but my mother's smile quickly faded when her eyes shifted to Sister Beatrice. She bowed her head and her chest heaved. She also must have uttered something audible, because Ernie's mom turned with a look of alarm and touched my mother's arm, like people do when they think someone is sick. My mother just closed her eyes and shook her head. We filed into our designated pews. As I was last, the girl to my left, sitting at the end of the pew nearest the center aisle, was Sister Beatrice. I felt nauseated, and only partly from the smell of alcohol emanating from her. We stood at the first song. Moments later, Ernie led the procession up the aisle, carrying the crucifix. Father Killian shuffled forward in his white and gold cassock, singing loudly, and ascended to his throne. When the song concluded, he gathered us in Christ's name and welcomed our parents and the members of the congregation. After leading us in the profession of faith, he sat. That was my cue. I stood to exit the pew and noticed that Valerie Johnson and her cadre of friends had all turned their heads to stare at me and giggle. I chastised myself for not having listened to Ernie, for allowing my hopes to get raised. Clearly, my classmates were waiting for me to fail. So, too, I was certain, was Sister Beatrice. I was supposed to genuflect before climbing the steps to the altar, but I was wondering what would happen to our well-rehearsed choreography if I vomited right in the middle of the center aisle. I wanted to be anywhere but in that church. God's will, it seemed, was to humiliate me. I caught sight of Ernie kneeling at the side of the altar, but he was looking past me, and when I followed his gaze, I saw Valerie Johnson leaning forward to whisper to one of the girls seated in the pew in front of her. I bent to a knee to genuflect, made the sign of the cross, and proceeded to the lectern, climbing the steps. Once at the podium, I adjusted the microphone as rehearsed. Then I reached for my readings, which the altar preparers were to place on the shelf in the lectern. But when I pulled out the pages, I realized, to my horror, that Valerie Johnson had replaced my readings with pages that, at a quick glance, contained old Hebrew words I didn't have a clue how to pronounce. As my anxiety built, I felt myself becoming red in the face, more and more nauseated, and burning up as if I had a fever. I didn't know what to do. And then I heard the bells. At first, I didn't know what was happening. No one did. I turned to the altar and saw that Ernie had grabbed the gold finger hold and was ringing the four altar bells with more vigor and enthusiasm than I had ever heard before or since in that church. Father Killian's head swiveled, his facial expression a mixture of confusion and annoyance. He swung his arm at Ernie as if swatting at an annoying bee. Unfortunately, Father Killian swatted exactly where the altar servers had set his glass of water on a side table, sending it sailing. I don't know who was the first to laugh, but from my vantage point, perched above the congregation, I saw students with hands clasped over their mouths, fighting desperately to keep from breaking into hysterics, most without success. After what seemed a full minute, Ernie set the bells down, cutting off the chimes. He looked like someone who had just committed a totally innocent mistake, but I knew better. I knew Ernie had rung those bells on purpose, even before he admitted it when we got home that afternoon. He said he knew Valerie and her friends had done something and deduced from my facial expression that they had switched the readings. Ernie had screwed up on purpose. Only Ernie Cantwell had the self-confidence to absorb the impending ridicule he had to know would result, not to mention Sister Beatrice's inevitable punishment. But his act worked. When I turned back to the lectern, I was no longer nervous, realizing that no matter how many words I fumbled or skipped, no one would be talking about anything except how Ernie had messed up on such a grand scale. I also realized something else. I didn't need the readings. I'd performed the actual readings so often I had darn near memorized every word, and I could see them now, on the pages, with all my mother's little pencil marks. I paused as my mother and I had rehearsed and looked out over the red sweaters filling the front half of the church pews and then to the parents. My mother's face beamed up at me, but now Ernie's mother looked as downcast as she had that day she'd come to our home to inform us that Ernie had a learning disability. Her dejection made me realize the extent of Ernie's sacrifice. When my eyes shifted to Sister Beatrice, she was scowling, her eyes blazing with fury. There would be hell to pay for Ernie. I looked last to Valerie Johnson and gave her a subtle, burning gaze that wiped the smile from her face and caused her to sit back in genuine fear. "A reading from the Book of Daniel," I began. Valerie Johnson's eyes widened, and she looked to Mary Beth Potts, who seemed equally perplexed. My classmates had chosen the readings, and they all were expecting the classic story of Daniel in the lion's den. I know this as fact because my mother kept the readings in a scrapbook, complete with her handwritten notes and pencil marks to cue my pronunciations as we had practiced. As I recited the story of the king throwing Daniel into the pit of lions, and how God rewarded Daniel's faith and devotion by sending an angel to protect him, I realized Ernie was my guardian angel, and had been since that first day on the playground. I completed the reading, certain I hadn't hit every word, but I had gotten close enough that no one noticed. Then I moved to the responsorial psalm. Again I paused, closing my eyes and seeing the reading in my mind's eye. My eyes shifted over the crowd. Sister Beatrice's face remained an angry mask. "God is my shepherd, I shall not want." I raised my palm, the gesture for the congregation to repeat the phrase, which they did in unison. "God is my shepherd, I shall not want. Though I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me." As I neared the end of the psalm, I knew I could not allow Ernie to walk into that valley of darkness alone. I was determined to walk beside him, whatever the consequences.
The second reading was a short letter from Paul to the Corinthians. "Brothers and sisters," I began. Paul was called to be an apostle by the will of God. I had also memorized this reading. The rest of the sentence read, "To tell you the good news of Jesus Christ, of his virginal birth, death on the cross, and resurrection from the dead." "To tell you the good news of Jesus Christ," I proclaimed in a loud voice that reverberated from the speakers. Then I said, "Of his vaginal birth." If I had done the reading at an ordinary Sunday Mass, no one would have cared. But this was not a Sunday Mass made up of an adult congregation. The congregation was grade school kids who still thought the funniest things in the world were the names given to the male and female sex organs. To say it in church was a mistake on a scale that trumped even ringing the bells at the wrong moment. The congregation sucked in and held its collective breath. But, like Ernie, I had no intention of allowing this mistake to go unnoticed. "Sorry." I cleared my throat and started over as the snickering began. "To tell you the good news of Jesus Christ," I repeated. "Of his vaginal..." I shook my head. "His virginal birth." That did it. There is nothing more contagious than a suppressed snicker in a church, and Ernie had already warmed up the crowd. Once the giggling started, it spread like a wave and soon became outright laughter. I watched, transfixed, as David Butterfield, a seventh grader sitting at the end of a pew, doubled over in laughter, lost his balance, and tumbled into the center aisle. If saying the word vagina in church was funny, watching a student roll out of a pew was downright hysterical. The nuns popped up from their seats, marching like penguins from one pew to the next, unsuccessfully trying to restore order. I looked at my mother. I didn't want to, but I was drawn to her. We had worked so hard for this moment, and she had been so proud. I expected to see abject disappointment and sorrow, but my mother did not look disappointed or even sad. Not in the least. She was smiling, a hand covering her mouth to suppress her own laugh. 16. My classmates and I marched in silence from the church narthex into the schoolyard. The nuns remained furious. Sister Beatrice waited until the door to our classroom had slammed shut before she unleashed her verbal assault, and it was a doozy. "Ernie Cantwell, you are a buffoon! And Sam Hill, you are a disgrace to your class, to your school, and to this community! Do not think for a minute I don't know what happened in there this morning. Do not think for 1 minute I believe either of you is innocent in any of this. Do you think the church is a stage for your comedic routines? Do you think this was funny? I do." For a second, no one reacted. As with the bells in the church, the comment was so foreign, I think everyone was trying to decide if they'd heard it. I hadn't said it, and I knew it wasn't Ernie. The voice was higher pitched, a girl's voice. We all turned in unison. Mickey Kennedy sat in the last desk of the first row. "I think it was hilarious, and I say we take a vote," she said, thrusting her hand into the air. Mickey's defiance was so brazen, so outrageous, I think most of my classmates forgot the gravity of the situation. Because just as suddenly, half of them raised their hands. "Put your hands down!" Sister Beatrice screamed. She wheeled on Mickey, but, unable to find words, stood there with her face growing darker shades of red, like a child holding her breath. For one brief moment, I thought her head might explode. "How dare you!" she finally bellowed. "How dare you! You!" She looked like one of those robots stuck in a corner that can do nothing but turn and pivot, turn and pivot. Finally, she grabbed the seating chart from Sister Mary Williams's desk. "How dare you, Miss Kennedy," Mickey said, "like the president, but we're not related." "Michaela Kennedy," Sister blurted.
My name is Mickey, she corrected. What are you so mad about? At least Mass wasn't the same old boring stuff.
The color drained from Sister Beatrice's face. She looked as though she might faint. She hurried down the aisle, hovering over Mickey like the witch over Dorothy, apparently unsure where to begin. For some bizarre reason, she chose to say, "We do not use nicknames in this school."
"Then why does everyone call you Sister Beaver?"
It was Sister Beatrice's nickname, though I'm not certain when exactly I first heard it. Because of her two prominent front incisors, the older students had dubbed Sister Beatrice Beaver, or Beeve for short. Sister Beatrice yanked Mickey from her seat by the arm, half dragging her out of the room. When the door slammed shut, Ernie and I looked knowingly at each other. Having just acted to save each other, we suspected Mickey, too, had choreographed her actions, though she had taken it a step or two further, something that would become a common occurrence throughout our lifelong friendship. What we didn't understand was why Mickey had done it. She didn't owe us anything. In fact, I had largely ignored her, still miffed that she'd taken my place as Ernie's playground sidekick. 5 minutes after Sister Beatrice departed, one of the lay women from the office came into our classroom looking harried and confused.
"You are to take out your reading books and begin reading in silence," she said. "If anyone speaks, I am to send you to the principal's office."
No one did. Mickey did not show up on the playground at lunch, nor did she return to the classroom that afternoon. Neither did Sister Beatrice. She'd perhaps forgotten about Ernie's and my detentions. Mary Beth Potts and Valerie Johnson sat like statues, paralyzed by their fear that I would tell on them. I never did. After school, Ernie and I ran out with our classmates like prisoners on a jailbreak, and we rode as fast as we could until we reached my front yard. When I walked in the front door, I detected an aroma familiar to every child: chocolate chip cookies. My mother had just taken a tray out of the oven. She placed a plate on the table along with two glasses of milk. The right side of her mouth inched into a grin as she looked from Ernie to me.
"You have inherited your mother's acting skills, Samuel Hill."
17. Mickey returned to class the following Monday. So did Sister Mary Williams. None of us ever spoke of the travesty that was the all-school mass. Late in the morning, Sister instructed us to take out our math books, then called my name and asked me to accompany her outside the classroom. I thought for certain this conversation would be about me paying the piper. We sat on the red lunch bleachers, the masonry wall hiding us from the rest of my classmates, who were no doubt peering out the window.
"I heard about what happened," Sister said.
"I'm sorry, Sister."
Her watery eyes held a kindness and warmth.
"I think we both know what you and Ernie did, Sam."
I didn't respond. She sighed.
"Sister Beatrice has some problems," she said. "She doesn't mean the things she says and does. Do you understand?"
I knew it had to do with the silver flask.
"I think so," I said. "You're a good boy, Sam. God gave you a cross to bear, just as he gave me one."
"You, Sister?" I asked. She removed her thick glasses, which had already turned a dark shade since we had ventured outdoors, and I noticed that her eyes, without them, were rather small, beady.
"I'm legally blind, Sam. These glasses only partially correct my vision. As I get older, I will go completely blind."
"When, Sister?"
"Only God knows."
I felt myself becoming angry. How could God take the eyesight of such a warm, loving person and leave such a rotten person as Sister Beatrice with 20/20 vision?
"Everything happens for a reason," Sister Mary Williams said, sounding very much like my mother. "I might not have become a nun or a teacher had it not been for my eyes. I am so sensitive to light, I have always had to wear sunglasses, even as a young girl. The other children called me Batgirl because I was as blind as one. The only place I found comfort outside my home was in church.
I could take off my glasses and feel normal. Everything God does is for a reason, Sam. Every cross we bear is an opportunity. Do you understand?
I think so, I said, though I was becoming less sure I wanted to understand.
She slipped her glasses back on.
You and Ernie will remain 15 minutes after school to clean the chalkboards and the erasers.
Yes, sister. When we stood from the bleachers, I felt a compulsion too strong to ignore. It surprised me, and it surprised Sister Mary Williams. I reached out and hugged her. After a moment, I felt the warmth of her hand atop my head.
I'm glad you became a teacher, I said.
At recess, Ernie and I found Mickey waiting in line for her chance to kick the ball.
Did you get in trouble? I asked.
My parents grounded me for a month. I can't watch TV.
Sorry about that, I said.
I didn't do it because I like you or anything, she said.
I didn't mean that. I just
forget it, Hill. Mickey raced forward and booted the ball high over everyone's heads, then took off running away from me, something that would become a habit for Mickey Kennedy. 18. 2 years later, 1971, my parents dropped me off at school in my graduation cap and gown, which, as luck would have it, were red and only served to further bring out the color of my eyes. The class was buzzing with excitement for our big night. We would graduate in the church, then walk through the playground to the gymnasium for our first dance. Ernie greeted me when I walked in the door of the classroom.
We made it, Hill! We are escaping this prison! I can't wait to get out of here!
I smiled, but I wasn't sure I shared the same sentiment. My years at OLM had been anything but smooth, though they'd improved after David Bateman was banished, and got better still when, at the end of the summer following sixth grade, we came back to school to find an interim principal, Sister Mary Frances. No one said what had happened to Sister Beatrice. Like David Bateman, she'd simply vanished, like a ghost. This meant my seventh and eighth grade years were relatively pain-free. While I couldn't look back on grammar school with fond memories, I was more apprehensive about the thought of starting over again at St. Joseph's, the all-boys Catholic high school Ernie and I would attend, and trying to win over a bunch of kids who would once again not know anything about me except that I had red eyes. I took my seat at my desk as our first lay teacher, Miss Trimble, went over the graduation ceremony one final time. Despite my screw-up at the all-school mass, I had been chosen by Miss Trimble as one of three students to give a reflection. The written pages were supposed to be at the lectern, but I'd kept a copy on me, just in case. When I opened my desk to retrieve the pages, I found a gift-wrapped package. I pulled it out thinking a similar package was in each student's desk, but no one else was holding one. I looked to Valerie Johnson, certain I would open the package and a snake would pop out, or a stink bomb, but Valerie was not paying any attention to me. She and her friends were engrossed in talk about their dresses, makeup, and the dance. I unwrapped the package. Inside, I found a Bible. Perplexed, I flipped it open. It had been inscribed in flowing, cursive handwriting. Samuel, may God bless you and watch over you on your new adventure in high school. Sister Beatrice. I shut the book as if to trap a rattlesnake. My pulse had quickened, and I was suddenly very hot in my graduation gown. After a moment, I slowly opened the Bible and peeked inside to confirm what I'd read. I quickly shut it.
Sam, Ernie said from his seat one row over. You okay? You look like you saw a ghost.
I felt like I'd seen a ghost. I'm fine, I said. I gave the gift to my mother after graduation, but didn't have time to talk to her before the dance. I was apprehensive about that as well, certain I'd be eating cookies and drinking punch alone until it was time to leave. But Mickey Kennedy would have none of that. She grabbed my hand the moment I walked in the door and pulled me out onto the dance floor. As she writhed and bounced and danced, I stood flat-footed to the Rolling Stones, Brown Sugar.
I don't know what to do, I shouted over the music. Just move, Hill.
How? Any way you want.
And so I did. I'm sure I must have looked like a kid with his pants on fire, but I did my best to imitate and stay up with Mickey. In no time, the dance floor was so crowded you couldn't move much anyway. That's when the music changed to Rod Stewart's Maggie May. I turned to go sit down, but Mickey, once again, would have none of it.
I don't bite, Hill. Besides, I heard the dance ladies are worse than the lunch Nazis. We must keep 6 inches between us to make room for the Holy Spirit.
You think you can stand dancing 6 inches from me?
I could.
I hadn't realized it before, or maybe I had, but I knew then. As I danced with one arm around Mickey's waist and my other, sweaty hand holding hers, that I liked Mickey. Like being the limits of an eighth grader's affection for someone of the opposite sex. I liked her a lot. At home that night, my mother had the Bible out on the kitchen counter. My father looked just as perplexed as I was when I'd first opened it. My mother simply smiled.
Wasn't that a lovely gesture on her part, she said.
But why did she do it? I asked.
To let you know that she's keeping you in her prayers.
Why? The woman hates me.
She doesn't hate you, Samuel.
But isn't this kind of hypocritical?
Don't question her motive, Samuel. Just accept the gift and be grateful for it.
I stuck the Bible on my dresser, never intending to look at it again. I would have thrown it out, but I thought there was some rule against throwing out Bibles and rosaries, and I didn't want to be trapped in purgatory for having done so. Throughout high school and college, that Bible remained on my dresser. When my mother died and I sold the house, I found it still there, without even a layer of dust. It is now on a shelf in my living room. We all moved on to high school. Me with my red eyes, Ernie the only black kid, and Mickey, the third misfit. Her mother and father would enroll her at the Sisters of Providence, the all-girls Catholic school in Burlingame. But Mickey would not last her freshman year. Officially, she transferred to the local public school. That's what her prospective college applications would state. Unofficially, she'd been expelled for smoking at a school dance, but even that didn't tell the whole story. Tired of the nuns and what she considered her stifling Catholic education, Mickey orchestrated her expulsion just as she had orchestrated her detention in the sixth grade. She came on to a senior at a dance, one everyone in Burlingame knew to be a pothead. The nuns did catch her smoking, but it wasn't cigarettes, and it wasn't at the dance. Mickey was in the back seat of the guy's car, sucking marijuana smoke from his mouth. Part 4. Nightmares and Fantasies. 1. 1989, Burlingame, California. David Bateman pulled open my car door, businesslike and professional. Step out of the car, please. I remember Bateman as being a good head taller than me as a boy, but when I got out of the car, the disparity in our sizes was more pronounced. The Marines had trimmed the fat and sculpted Bateman's body. His biceps stretched the fabric of his blue uniform, and his forearms looked like woven ropes, complete with a tattoo of the Marine Corps symbol, an eagle atop a globe. David, I managed to say, trying to sound like an adult and not a scared little boy. Bateman held a long metal flashlight and directed it to a gold badge clipped to his breast pocket. It's Officer Bateman. I didn't respond. Say it. Say what?
Say Officer Bateman. I hesitated until I remembered the 5 beers I had consumed. I was in no position to piss him off. Officer Bateman. He considered my wallet in the beam of light. So, the Devil Boy is now Dr. Devil Boy, huh? What kind of doctor are you? No, let me guess. You're an eye doctor.
Ophthalmologist, I said.
He looked up from my wallet. Are you suggesting I'm stupid?
No, I was just,
I know what an eye doctor is. I don't need you to tell me.
I bit my tongue.
Have you been drinking tonight, doctor?
I had a couple beers watching the game.
I had a couple beers watching the game, Officer Bateman.
he corrected, then cupped his hand to his ear like a drill sergeant.
I had a couple of beers watching the game, Officer Bateman.
He shone the light directly in my eyes, causing me to squint and look away.
That's funny. I could have sworn your eyes used to be red. Is that what happens when you're full of shit? Do your eyes turn brown?
I'd had enough. What do you want, David?
What do I want?
He seemed to consider this. Then he said, I want you to turn around and put your hands on the roof of the car. That's what I want.
What for?
He grabbed me by the collar, spun me around, and immediately kicked my legs apart. His steel-toed boot hit my ankle bone, and the pain caused my leg to buckle, dropping me to my knees.
Get up, he shouted, grabbing me and lifting me to my feet. I didn't say give me a blowjob. I said put your hands on the roof of the car and spread your legs.
Though my ankle felt as though it was on fire, I managed to get to my feet. Bateman grabbed my right wrist and wrenched it behind my back, snapping on a cuff and pinching the skin. My left arm followed. The billy club pressed my head against the roof.
Now, I want you to listen, and I want you to listen real good. You ready?
Yes. He shoved my head against the roof of the car.
Yes, Officer Bateman,
I managed.
Let me give you a little piece of advice. You fix my daughter's eyes and you leave it at that. I find you talking to my ex-wife or anyone else about what you think may or may not have happened, and I'm gonna come looking for you. And next time, I'm not gonna let you off with a warning. Do we understand one another?
He shoved my head against the roof again.
It's impolite not to respond.
Yes, I said.
I didn't hear you,
he said in the voice of that drill sergeant.
Yes, Officer Bateman. Good.
After another moment, he began releasing the cuffs.
I'm in a good mood tonight, and I know you only have a few blocks to go to get home, so I'm gonna let you go without a field sobriety test.
I heard him step back, thinking the worst over. Then the billy club whapped me hard across the back of my hamstrings, a pain that dropped me again to my knees. Had I not grabbed the door handle of the car, I would have collapsed onto the pavement. I stayed there, fighting back the pain and the humiliation, recalling how, as a little boy, I had lain on the ground at Ray Park Playground until I could no longer hear Bateman and his two goons. I pulled myself to my feet, the backs of my legs stinging. David Bateman sat behind the wheel of his patrol car. He smiled as he drove off. 2. By the time I got home, the pain in my ankle and the backs of both thighs was so excruciating I could barely limp upstairs. I made it to the bathroom and shimmied out of my pants. Using Eva's hand mirror, I examined the damage. The baton had left inflamed red lines, each 6 inches long and an inch wide, across the backs of my thighs. They looked like two massive tapeworms burrowing beneath the skin. The capillaries around the welts had burst, causing a spattering of bright red blotches, but from what I could tell in the mirror, it was unlikely I would develop a hematoma, though the backs of both legs would eventually become ugly bruises. I gingerly made my way downstairs to the kitchen and cracked ice cubes into two towels. Closing the refrigerator, I noticed the magnetized notepad on which Eva and I left each other messages. I took it with me as I made my way to the sofa, gently placing the towels with ice beneath each leg and slowly sitting. The fabric of the towels rubbed the welts, aggravating the pain, but I forced myself to stay seated, resting my head back against the cushion. I felt like that 7-year-old boy again, the one forced to lie about my beating, calling it a bike accident. I had realized, even at that young age, that no one could protect me, no matter how much they said they could. And then another thought came to me, and it frightened me so much, I sat up. I'd been right. David Bateman had hit his daughter in the head. He had seriously injured her, maybe blinded her in one eye. And that wasn't all. Bateman knew I was an ophthalmologist. He knew where I practiced and lived, and he knew that his ex-wife had come to see me. He was stalking her, and in so doing, he was stalking me. That was the reason for Trina Crouch's ardent denial. She had reached the same conclusion I had reached as that young, beaten boy. She and her daughter were on their own. She could not call the law. Her ex-husband was the law. To whom was Trina Crouch going to run? To whom was she going to protest? It was why she had laughed at my suggestion that I could somehow help her. Help her? Help her how? What was I going to do? Call the police? I picked up the phone and dialed the number for the hotel in Boston, not even considering the 3-hour time difference. I asked for Eva Pryor's room, and in the moments before it rang, I fought to pull myself together and not sound like a child. The phone rang twice before I heard the receiver lift. Hello? The voice was groggy, muffled. Someone awakened from a dead sleep, face maybe still buried in a pillow, brain not quite aware, but most definitely male. Hello? He said, this time more forcefully. And just as I was about to say, sorry, wrong room, I heard covers rustling and the faint whisper of Eva's panicked voice. Shit, she said. 3. 1971. St. Joe's High School, San Mateo, California. My transition to high school was not the same as my rude introduction to grammar school, but it was also not a smooth landing. I believe my high school teachers were forewarned about the kid with the red eyes. As for my classmates, there was an initial coolness those first few days I caught them staring at me and whispering in the hallways. But my friendship with Ernie went a long way toward breaking the ice. At a school where sports were revered, Ernie became an instant rock star, and I was accepted like one of his roadies. No one dared to insult me with Ernie Cantwell at my side, and eventually, the larger environment allowed me to blend in, to the extent I was ever able to blend in. At St. Joe's, kids were lumped into groups. You had your jocks, the nerds, the dorks, and the stoners. I straddled the lines between the nerds, dorks, and jocks, with jocks being the most tenuous. Though I was far from an impressive athlete either in build or ability, I did make the freshman basketball team on sheer determination and hustle. My coach told me, in a not-so-ringing endorsement, "How can I cut a kid who tries so hard with so little success?" I didn't care. Making the team gave me the chance to show my classmates that I was just a normal kid, except for my condition. I didn't get the chance to play in games very often, but when coach did put me in, usually when we were way ahead or way behind on the scoreboard, I swarmed my opponent like a whirling dervish, and the combination of my red eyes and pest-like defense frequently rattled him into mistakes. My teammates and the few fans that came to those games loved it and responded with cheers like, "Give him hell! Give him hell!" The nickname stuck. For the remainder of my 4 years at St. Joe's, I was hell. My mother didn't like it, but unlike Devil Boy, I did not perceive the name as derogatory or negative. At an all-boys school, it seemed everyone had a nickname, and mine was rather benign compared with others. 4. I was 6 the first time my parents took me to the 16 Mile House restaurant to celebrate my birthday. My father had me convinced that at any moment Wyatt Earp and other gunslingers of the Wild West would push through the swinging doors and mosey up to the wood and copper bar in boots with spurs or sit at one of the round tables to eat a flame-broiled New York steak. I loved the wood plank floors strewn with sawdust and the man in the top hat and striped shirt who played an upright piano. Every year I ordered the steak, baked potato, and salad. I thought it just about the best restaurant in the world. But this night, my 16th birthday, I was preoccupied. "Sam, slow down," my mother said as I dug into another piece of meat. "You'll choke if you don't chew your food." That morning, my father had kept his promise and taken me to the Department of Motor Vehicles to obtain my driver's license.